Shalom. Welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Bat Shlomo, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, of course, I'm going to speak about the election that's taking place, this critical historic election in the next 3 weeks. We've been concentrating on this election and on defeating Barack Hussein Obama and warning about Barack Hussein Obama for 6 years now. If you think about it, since early 2007, we've been warning about Obama. And we did many, many numerous videos throughout 2007, 2008, and then throughout Obama's presidency. So it's been 6 years where a very large percentage of our videos in English and in Hebrew have been about Obama and the need to defeat Obama and the danger that Obama poses. And now in about 3 weeks, we're going to face a very, very important decision. And I just want people to understand that I'm going to be discussing shortly, after I give a recap of where I think we stand in the polls and what I think the situation is politically, once again, I'm going to try to bring home to our great JTFers just why this election is so important. Because the vice presidential debate, once again, demonstrated to us just how much is at stake. We're literally talking about the danger of a nuclear holocaust if, God forbid, Barack Hussein Obama and Joe Biden are reelected. And we're going to discuss that. And the vice presidential debate proves that beyond any doubt, just how much is at stake in this election. But first, let's see where we stand. And the reason I'm going to go through the polls, a slight discussion of where I think the race stands, is because there's a tendency, and it's human nature, but we're all human beings in JTF too. We have the same tendencies as other human beings. There's a tendency either to be overconfident or to be overly depressed or to go all the way up or all the way down. We shouldn't be overconfident and we shouldn't think it's hopeless. We should be realistic. Realistically speaking, the latest polls show a very close election in the popular vote contest. In the race for the popular vote, the national popular vote, the latest polls show that it's very close. The two candidates are almost tied in most of the polls. Very, very close race. But in the Electoral College, Barack Hussein Obama, according to most polls, is still leading. And the Electoral College is what elects the president. So we still have a challenge ahead of us. That doesn't mean we can't change that. That doesn't mean that Mitt Romney cannot gain the momentum he needs to overtake Obama in enough states to reach 270 electoral votes, which is what you need to get elected. It is possible. It is something that can be done, possibly. But it's a tough battle. Right now, they're even in the popular vote, but in the battle for the Electoral College, Obama, according to most polls, is leading right now. He has a lead. Again, it's not an insurmountable lead. It's not an impossible lead. But right now, if you look at most polls, he would appear to have an advantage in the Electoral College. And among early voters, and I put up a thread about this on the forum, I didn't want to cause panic, but I saw so many of our great members wanting to be optimistic, which again is human nature, and I understand that. And I also want to be optimistic, but I saw so many of our great members putting up posts as if the election was over, as if, oh, Mitt Romney now is going to win. I mean, the fact is, in early voting, Barack Hussein Obama is already winning. Among people who cast their ballots early, in 40 states now, you can now cast your ballot by mail or in some cases in person now early. It's called early voting. And by the way, there's a lot of potential for fraud in early voting. So you can imagine the situation is not the best situation for us when you have these early voting, scenarios. Obama has a big lead, according to several polls, in early voting. People who are voting early, which is, again, I've seen some polls show only 2% of people have voted early. Some say 7%. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but people who have already voted, among those people, most of them, according to polls, have voted for Obama. So he's leading among people who have actually voted already. So this is not by any means a situation where we could be confident and sit back and say, oh, Mitt Romney's going to win. That is just, believe me, that is not true. If anybody tells you that, they're kidding themselves. We have a tough fight here. And if anybody tells you the opposite, that this race is over, that's also not true. We saw one debate, one victory by Mitt Romney in a 90-minute debate changed a lot of the polls and gives Mitt Romney a fighting chance now. And he's now even in the polls in the battle for the national popular vote, at least, and he's even in many of the swing states. So we saw that we do have a chance. So what I'm saying is, let's not be overconfident and let's not be discouraged and depressed and give up and throw our hands up in the air. Both of those attitudes are incorrect here. And by the way, in any situation, even if it was a situation where it looked like we were going to win, we still should be active in fighting and do what we can to make sure that we win. We should never be overconfident. And even if it looked like the opposite, like it did 4 years ago in 2008 when it looked like we were going to lose, you still have an obligation to try your best because you never know for sure. You can turn the situation around, you never know for sure. 4 years ago at this time, if you recall, it looked pretty bad. I mean, Barack Hussein Obama was leading in all of the polls. John McCain looked like he was really in bad shape. And so it looked like we were going to lose. And of course, eventually Obama did win. He won by 7 points. He won 53% to 46%, a 7-point margin, which is a pretty big margin. And it looked that way at this point 4 years ago also. It looked like that was going to happen. But still, you don't, even when the odds are against you, you don't give up. Because you never know. Sometimes you can turn the situation around. And when the odds are in your favor, you shouldn't be overconfident because a good situation can turn bad overnight. Until all the votes are in and the election's over, you never know for sure. And in this election, this is especially true now. Because now it looks close. It looks like it's close. Obama has an edge right now in the Electoral College and among early voters. In the popular vote, it looks like it's about even. But that means this election can still go either way, depending on a number of factors, depending on the two upcoming debates that are going to be taking place, and depending on who gets their vote out and how much people are motivated to vote. All of those things will make a difference. So we should be very active and put everything we've got into this election. It's very, very important. Tuesday night's debate between Mitt Romney, this coming Tuesday night's debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Hussein Obama will be very important, will be critical. And so, JTFers, once again, let's pray to God that he helped Mitt Romney decisively defeat Barack Hussein Obama in that debate. We should pray to God. We don't know what God's plans are or what his reasons are. He may not grant our request because he knows best and he has his reasons. Maybe we don't deserve it. God forbid, maybe we don't deserve it. But we should pray to him that he should be merciful, that we ask him for him to be merciful to us and to forgive us and to help America and Israel and to help his people in Israel. That prayer goes a long way with God because this is very important for Israel. So we should pray. We definitely should say a prayer. We definitely should be praying about Tuesday night's debate because it can affect a lot of things that are coming up. Now, let's discuss, now that we've discussed where the race stands, it's close. We have a chance. Obama, by certain measures, still has an edge. But the race is close and we have a shot. That's basically where we stand here. I would say that we have a little bit less than a 50-50 chance of winning. I'm being realistic here. I'm being brutally honest. I think we have less than a 50-50 chance of winning, but not much less. So we've got a shot. And a lot depends on what happens in the debates, and a lot depends on what happens in the day-to-day campaigning and everything that everyone does to try to influence the outcome. But anyway, understanding that now, once again, the vice presidential debate shows us just how crucial this election is. This is, I think, one of the most important elections, maybe the most important election in the United States that I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm almost 56 years old. And I've been following politics since I was a young boy. So I've seen a lot of elections. I think this is probably the most important election I've ever seen. Because what's at stake here is the possibility of a nuclear Iran. And a nuclear Iran can, God forbid, lead to a nuclear arms race among all the Muslim terrorist states and to a nuclear Holocaust, God forbid. It could lead to a nuclear Holocaust against the Jews of Israel, God forbid. It can lead to a nuclear Holocaust in the United States, God forbid. All of those things are possible. Iran is already at war with the United States as well, by the way. The United States, even Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, Yimach Shmo, who is an appeaser of Iran, even he said Iran is already waging a cyber war against the United States. Iran is attacking American companies and American websites. Iran is hacking and attacking in a very coordinated, massive effort. And it is already, there have already been some consequences. So they're already in a cyber war against the United States. But the danger of them having nuclear bombs, I mean, these people are religious fanatics and lunatics. Putting nuclear bombs in their hands would be insanity. Insanity. Allowing them to acquire those weapons is insanity. It's showing that we learned nothing from the Holocaust 80 years ago, and it shows that we learned nothing from 9/11, and it shows that we've just learned nothing about Islam. It would be just complete madness. And it is madness that we are not doing what has to be done to stop them. But the vice presidential debate really showed how the Obama-Biden administration intends to let Iran develop nuclear bombs and intends to try to stop Israel from taking the necessary action against Iran militarily, and has already been doing that. They've already been stopping Israel by pressuring Israel, and the Israeli leaders, unfortunately, have been listening to their pressure, which is terrible. They should not listen. Israel should go and strike. They should have destroyed Iran's nuclear bomb-making program 20 or 30 years ago. But the fact is, they even now, when the knife is at the throat, they're still listening to Obama's pressure. And in the vice presidential debate, we really saw what the position of this evil administration is. Joe Biden dismissed the Iranian nuclear threat. Joe Biden said that Iran, quote, has a long way to go, unquote, until they acquire nuclear weapons. In other words, he contradicted and dismissed the warnings of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Even Netanyahu, who is an appeaser, has said that by the spring or at the latest the summer, it will be too late to stop them. That we must take action, that we're coming to the point where it's going to be too late, that we don't have a lot of time left. Even Netanyahu made that warning at the United Nations in his speech at the UN. Biden, in the debate, dismissed all of that, lying and saying that Iran, quote, has a long way to go, unquote, until they develop nuclear bombs. He basically was saying we have nothing to worry about. We can just sit around and hope the sanctions will take effect, even though we've had sanctions against Iran now for 25 years. And they haven't stopped Iran's nuclear program. The Iranians have said, and the Iranian people, and by the way, this is one issue on which the Iranian people agree with their government. The Iranian people want Iran to have nuclear bombs. And they are willing to face sanctions and to face a very difficult economic situation if necessary. They've shown that they're willing to do that in order to acquire nuclear weapons. Because once they get the nuclear weapons, then it's too late. Then nobody can touch them. That's the way they look at things. And yet Biden told us we have nothing to worry about. He told us Israel and Netanyahu and all the warnings of all the experts in the United States and in Israel, all that's wrong, he said. He said, no. He said the position of the Obama administration is that Iran has a long way to go. We don't have to worry about that right now. He said that even if they develop, he conceded that they have the centrifuges, they're building the fissionable material. He said even if they reach the point where they can build enough fissionable material to actually create nuclear bombs, he said even if they reach that point that Netanyahu was showing in his diagram that he drew at the UN, even if they reach that point, we have nothing to worry about, Biden said, because they then would have to build the nuclear bomb in order to put the fissionable material in a nuclear bomb. He said they still have to build a nuclear bomb. He said they didn't build a nuclear bomb yet. Netanyahu and the Israeli government and Israeli intelligence have already said it would take them weeks and at most months to build the bomb once they have the fissionable material ready. It would only take weeks, perhaps weeks, at the most months, for them to actually build the bombs once they have that material ready. So Biden was lying, and unfortunately Paul Ryan didn't know enough to contradict him in the debate. He let him get away with that because I think Paul Ryan doesn't know. Paul Ryan is an expert on economic issues. He did not know this subject matter. Because he let Joseph Biden say things that were outright lies, that were complete lies covering up for the Iranian nuclear bomb-making program. And not only that, Paul Ryan did say that 20 times the Obama-Biden administration sought exemptions and sought to dilute the sanctions that Congress had passed against Iran, and that is true. Obama has consistently tried to dilute and gut the sanctions and take whatever power there was out of the sanctions. Whatever punch the sanctions had, he, until this election year, did everything he could to make the sanctions worthless. And he did succeed in doing that. The sanctions were a joke. They were a paper tiger. Until this past year, when it was election time, he decided to let some of the sanctions kick in. And even now, he's granting exemptions to China, Russia, and other countries so that they can be exempted from the sanctions, and they're continuing to supply Iran with everything that Iran needs. Obama is granting them exemptions. Instead of saying, you want to deal with us, you want trade with us, you stop helping Iran. You're going to abide by these sanctions too if you want the United States of America to have trade with you or to deal with you. That's what Obama should be doing. That's what the United States should be doing. Obama will never do that because he's a Muslim Jew-hating piece of filth. But the fact is, that's what the United States should be doing. Imposing real sanctions that really bite much more than these. Instead, he's giving exemptions. He's still, to this day, he's still diluting the sanctions. And Biden lied and deceived everybody and said, well, first of all, we have the same position as the Israeli government, and we're in this, and the Israeli government agrees with us on this. That's complete. He flatly contradicted everything that Israel has been warning about, everything Netanyahu said in his UN speech, everything that all the experts have been warning about. Flatly contradicted all of it and just created a brand new scenario that no one, no serious person in the intelligence community would agree with. That Iran is a long way away and we have nothing to worry about. I mean, that is completely, completely bogus and completely untrue. And he is covering for the Iranian Muslim terrorist regime when he says that. And that is what he and Obama stand for. They want us to accept a nuclear terrorist Iran, a nuclear terrorist armed Iran. They don't admit that because it's unpopular, because most Americans would be very worried about that prospect, justifiably. So they don't admit that that's what their policy is, but that is what their policy is. They are not willing to take the real action that's needed to stop this, which is military action. And even in terms of, there has to be military action against Iran. And it would, and by the way, if the United States did it, it would take a couple of weeks of just bombings from the air, and that would solve the problem. It's not like Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries. You don't have to invade. Just bombing from the air and destroying their military facilities, destroying their oil industry, destroying all that, that would be it. And yes, oil prices would go up temporarily. But in the long term, oil prices would actually be much more stable. It would be much, if the threat of a nuclear Iran were eliminated, that would actually reduce oil prices in the long term tremendously. In the short term, there'd be a spike. There'd be a temporary spike if the United States or Israel took out their oil industry. But in the long term, it would create tremendous new stability in the oil market if the threat of a nuclear Iran and a nuclear arms race among Muslim nations was finally taken away, or was at least eliminated for at least the next several years, which is what a military strike would achieve. Now, in contrast to Obama, Biden, and other appeasing terrorist-supporting traitors like them, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan have said that a nuclear Iran is the biggest threat to America, the number one threat to the United States, and the United States must stop this by all means. So they've taken a much more realistic position on this. They've agreed with Netanyahu that there has to be a red line drawn, something which Obama and Biden refused to do. They have agreed that urgent action must be taken and that Iran must be given an ultimatum to stop or else. And if they don't stop by a date certain and after an ultimatum, then the military option becomes active. That's the Israeli position, and Romney has basically endorsed the Israeli position. Whereas Obama and Biden are doing everything possible to allow Iran to complete the building of these nuclear bombs without meaningful action against it. So what we're talking about in this election is preventing a nuclear holocaust, the real threat of a nuclear holocaust. That is literally what is at stake in this election, nothing less. That's why we've spent the past 6 years devoting a very large number of our videos and a very large number of our SJTF shows and a very large number of our activities in English and in Hebrew to this issue. And why in Hebrew? Because Israel, we've been warning for years that Israel should ignore Obama's pressure and Israel should go in and take action against Iran herself. Of course, we don't have the financial support and we don't have a big enough budget so that we can make the real big impact that we wanted to make on that issue. And so we haven't been able to convince Israel, and JTF hasn't been able to get Israel to do what a JTF wants. Obviously, we don't have the budget or the strength to do that. We haven't been able to do that. But I could tell you that the people we have reached with our videos, I think we've convinced quite a few people that have seen our videos that this is a much more urgent issue, and we've made it a more urgent issue, at least among the people who do see our videos. And many, many Israelis have been exposed to our videos. Many Israelis do go to our videos and do see our videos. So in both English and in Hebrew, we've spent 6 years warning about this issue as it relates to Obama. The Iranian issue we've been speaking about for 20 years, more than 20 years. But the issue of Obama and how Obama endangers Israel and endangers America in terms of a nuclearized Iran, for 6 years we've been warning about this. For 6 whole years. In 3 weeks, we're going to know whether or not we're finally going to get a president who defends American national interests against a nuclear holocaust, against the threat of a nuclear holocaust from Muslim terrorists. We're going to find that out in about 3 weeks. Let's hope and pray that we do succeed in the election, because if not, then we may see the fulfillment of those biblical prophecies that say that huge numbers of people are going to be killed and that there's going to be terrible destruction and many other things that are prophesied in the Bible. There's a rule in the Bible. Good prophecies, when something good is prophesied, when something good that's supposed to happen is prophesied, it always happens. It will always come to pass. Eventually, one way or another, God will fulfill every good prophecy that is promised. Always. Sometimes it's delayed because of evil behavior, because people don't deserve it. Sometimes it's delayed. But eventually, one way or another, when the prophets promise something good, God, because he loves us and because he's so merciful and kind, God will eventually deliver on all the good prophecies. Bad prophecies, on the other hand, about people being killed and terrible crisis and starvation and death and destruction and massive numbers of people being burned, which is the nuclear holocaust scenario that we see huge scenarios of destruction and mass killing that the prophets speak about. All of that can be canceled. Bad prophecies can be canceled if people do the right thing. Those bad prophecies only come to pass if people are evil and deserve the bad prophecies. So let's hope that at least we earn enough mercy so that this can be stopped. Let's hope so. We have to do everything we can. We have to try our best. That's all we can do is try our best. And we've been warning and we've been doing the best we can with our very limited resources, but we can't be silent. We're not allowed to be silent in a situation like this. Anyway, what can we do? What can all of us? Every one of us should be doing something. Every one of us. Everyone listening to this video, to this SJTF show. Everybody should be doing something. And here are some of the things that we ask you to do. First of all, people can help us with our videos, both the English and the Hebrew. Even if you don't speak Hebrew, help us get the word out. When we put up on our English forum, when we put up threads showing you English and Hebrew videos, help us with both. Help us spread the word. You're doing something very important. That means liking, favoriting, and commenting on the videos. That means doing that both on ZooTube, on YouTube, which we call ZooTube, on both ZooTube and Facebook. Like the videos, comment on the videos, on YouTube, favorite the videos, and mirror the videos. Mirror the videos, reproduce the videos on your YouTube accounts. Do everything we can, do everything you can to promote those videos. When we put those videos out, they're important. The messages are important. If you yourselves want to create videos on these subjects, that's also good. That's also good. That's also important. You also want to speak out and warn. That's also helpful. And even more importantly than that, of course, we need financial support. Our meager, limited budget is the number one problem that we have. We would have been a mass movement a long time ago. If only we had a Sheldon Adelson that was supporting us the way he gives tens of millions of dollars to Newt Gingrich and these other causes. If we had a Sheldon Adelson backing us like that, we would have saved Israel. The whole world would be a completely different place. So much of a better place. But in the meantime, we are obligated to do what we can with what we have. We are not allowed to say, well, we don't have tens of millions, so we're not going to do anything. God forbid. We're obligated to do whatever we can with what we have. And we are making a difference with what we have. We're reaching people with our message and waking people up. That is important. And you never know. God may save all of Israel because of that. You never know. Who knows? Who knows what God does in His mercy, in His infinite mercy? Maybe God's just looking for an excuse because of His mercy and His love. He's just looking for an excuse to prevent disaster. He just wants to see us take the right steps and show that we're doing everything we can. Who knows? We need financial support. The more help we get financially, the more we can do. People, we have great JTFers that go to the JTF.org main page and to the Hayamin.org main page. On those main pages, we've got the donate button on top, and people very conveniently, in a matter of minutes, can make credit card donations by just clicking on the donate button. And we have wonderful JTFers who are doing that. God bless you. God bless you and your family and your loved ones, both in this world and in the next. And we have JTFers, just as important, who are sending us checks and money orders and cash donations through the regular mail to our post office box. Very, very important. God bless you and your families and your loved ones, both in this world and in the next. You're doing something very important. Very important. You're showing that you're not going to be silent, that you want to support those who are telling the truth and who have consistently told the truth, and that you want the truth to be told, and you want people to wake up, and you want things to be done so that we can save the world from a terrible tragedy. And finally, so we've mentioned helping with the videos, spreading the word with the videos, financial support. Finally, the third thing again, prayers. We need people to pray for both a Romney victory in November and in the debates on the Tuesday night debate. We need people to pray. We should, on all of these subjects, we need prayers. Prayer is important. Prayer, I believe in prayer. Prayer does make a difference. It does make a difference. You know, even if you don't get what you wanted to get in a prayer, that doesn't mean it went to waste. You never know when that prayer that you made, and all the prayers that you have composed, all the prayers to God, you never know when God is going to do something to reward you for having prayed or taken that into account in some situation in the future, even if it's not in the situation which you pray about. You never know. Prayer makes a difference. God wants us to pray and wants us to turn to Him. And it makes a difference. And please pray for JTF to succeed and Hayamin Hamiti in Israel to succeed. Pray for that as well. We need your prayers. And so, and of course also, posting threads and posts on the video and responses on the forum. Posting threads on the forum and responses to threads on the forum, making the forum a more attractive place so that the thousands of people who come to the forum will want to join and will want to become active. That's also important. I mean, you see the statistics. You can see the statistics on the bottom of our general general page of the forum. You see on the bottom the stats. We have thousands of people visit our forum because of all of our videos. And whether they decide to join or not join, a lot of that depends on how attractive our forum is for people to join. We want to make the forum attractive. We want to make it interesting. We want people to want to join. So that's also important. Anyway, we have great JTFers that really are trying to help, that are trying to do the best they can, and I thank you for that, and may God bless you for that. We have JTFers that help us financially, and JTFers that help us with the videos, and JTFers that help us on the forum, and JTFers whose prayers are important. We have JTFers doing those things. So I want to thank you for all of that. God bless our great saintly members. And let's hope that we can make a difference. Okay, now let's get to our great questions here. If I can just get to it, I just got to move over here for a second. And here we go. And we start out with the great Selhar, who is very active on both the English and the Hebrew forums. Selhar writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why have radical leftists hijacked the issues of the environment and animal rights, unquote. Okay, excellent question, Selhar. They use those issues, Selhar. The issue of the environment is something that they use in order to prevent, for instance, energy independence. They don't want you've got certain companies and corporations that don't want America to become independent. For instance, on the issue of using coal, clean coal, they don't. So they say it's environmentally unsound to use coal. The fact is, coal, just to give you an example, coal is actually cleaner when it's with the new technology we have than oil. Oil actually causes more pollution than clean coal, than the new clean coal that we have. We have new clean coal technology. But people who want America to be dependent on Arab oil because they make more money from Arab and Muslim oil, this gives them greater profits, they are actually the ones who fund a lot of these environmental organizations. Why does the Ford Foundation, for instance, give so much money? And the Rockefeller Foundation, all these other foundations, why do they give so much money to environmental organizations and left-wing organizations? Because they're making money when America is dependent on foreign oil and on Muslim oil. And it's not just clean coal, it's all, many of the other different types of energy. So the environmental movement in many cases is something that's just used. And again, I'm not saying, of course, we're concerned about the future of the environment. We are concerned about the future of the environment. But there's nothing more dangerous to the environment than if someone sets off a nuclear bomb in the United States. That's the worst thing you could have for the environment in the United States. And that's what will happen if, God forbid, we continue to buy oil from Muslim countries. The left uses these issues. And you have people on the left that are not conscious of the fact that some of these issues are used in order to suppress, for instance, the production of American domestic energy. You have some people on the left. I mean, most of the activists on the left, they're not aware of that. They think that they're protecting the trees and the grass and the flowers and the animals. Now, but in fact, they're being manipulated. And as far as animal rights are concerned, one of the objectives of people on the left is to attack the Bible and attack morality and decency. They want us to say, we're all animals. Human beings are animals, we're all animals, and we're equal to the animals. They want us to say that we're equal to animals, that there's not a difference between human beings and animals. Now, of course, we love animals, and we're required, and with Judaism, we're required to love animals. They're God's creatures. We're required to be kind to animals, and we should love animals. But human beings are not on the same level as animals. And the animals' rights activists claim that we're all just animals. And this is an important Torah issue here. Because physically, we are animals. Physically. Physically, we have to eat just like animals have to eat. We have to sleep, and animals have to sleep. We reproduce just as animals reproduce. We breathe, and many of our bodily functions are the same as those of animals. So physically, you could say we are just another type of animal. But there's something different about a human being. Human beings are completely different on a whole different level. A dog, if you look at a group of dogs, or a group of elephants, or a group of monkeys 1,000 years ago, if you look at just a group of dogs, let's say, 1,000 years ago, and how they lived 1,000 years ago. And then you look at a group of dogs, how they live today. They haven't advanced or progressed in 1,000 years. They can't. They're not capable of it. They don't know how to progress. Or elephants 1,000 years ago lived the same way that elephants live today. Birds 1,000 years ago lived the same way that birds live today. They haven't developed new and more advanced technologies or lifestyles. They're not capable of it. But look at human beings today and human beings 1,000 years ago. Human beings can change things. Human beings can change the world. Human beings from generation to generation change things. They're capable of going beyond their instincts and rising above that. Human beings are not animals. We have a soul. And that's something that the animals' rights people and the leftists and the anti-religious people and the secular people don't want us to believe. They don't want us to believe in the human soul, and they don't want us to believe in things beyond the physical and beyond the things that they worship in this world. Those are just some of the philosophical clashes that come up and the ideological clashes that come up when speaking about animals' rights and animal rights and the environment. Anyway, thank you very much, Selhar. And now we go to the great Yimach Shmo to Obama, who writes, and I quote, "Der Chaim, has the civil war in Syria affected the Christian minority?" Unquote. Absolutely. About 10% of Syrians are Christian. Syria is about 90% Muslim and about 10% Christian. If you count the Druze as Muslims, the Druze are about 3% Druze, and they're an offshoot of Islam. But about 10% of Syria is Christian. And they're very worried because the anti-Assad forces that are trying to overthrow Assad, and Assad is a brutal Nazi mass murderer, a brutal butcher who's murdered already 30,000 of his own people. I mean, we've seen how brutal he is. But the anti-Assad people, who are supporters of Al-Qaeda and supporters of all types of Muslim terrorist organizations and who are jihadists, they are completely intolerant of Christians and of non-Muslims. So the Christian minority in Syria is very worried about that. They're very worried about the militias and the groups that are fighting against Assad. Not that Assad is a friend of the Christians, he's not. But they're very, very worried about what's coming in Syria and how it might affect them. Because they know how intolerant Islam is of other religions. Anyway, thank you very much, Yimach Shmo to Obama. And now we go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, "Why are the majority of American Jews Democrats?" Unquote. Great question. It's insane because the Democrat Party is an anti-Semitic party. Period. I mean, we saw that at the Democrat convention. They booed Jerusalem when the mention of the word Jerusalem came up, and they took it out of their platform and they booed. I mean, these are just anti-Semites. And it's been an anti-Semitic, hateful party for many, many years, ever since the days of Jimmy Carter and even before then. This is an anti-Semitic party. But Jews, most American Jews, unfortunately, are assimilated, intermarried. They have no Jewish values. They have no loyalty to their own people. They don't genuinely care about Israel. And so they unfortunately identify with groups and people who are hostile to their own people's survival. And they don't even care because they don't even look upon themselves as Jews anymore. They don't even care. And so we have this unfortunate situation. This is what assimilation and intermarriage and the ravages of living outside of Israel do. The only place where there's a future for the Jewish people is in Israel. America is a beautiful, magnificent country, or was a beautiful, magnificent country. We'll see on election day if it stays that way. But America was a beautiful, magnificent country for the Gentiles. Not for Jews. The homeland of the Jews is Israel. That is the only homeland of the Jewish people. In every country in the world, the Jewish population is shrinking because of assimilation and intermarriage. Jews are disappearing. There's a spiritual holocaust going on. The only country in the world where the Jewish population is growing and growing at a healthy pace is in Israel. In Israel, you have natural population growth. Jews have babies in Israel, and Jews are growing in Israel. And it's the right type of Jews. The majority of Jewish babies in Israel now are religious. The majority of babies born every year now are from religious homes. Israel is the only healthy, normal place for the Jews to live. It's the only place where there's a Jewish future. If you live outside of Israel, this is the type of decay and rot and decadence and self-hating behavior that you're going to see. Anyway, thank you very much, Chicago Jew. And now we go to the Great British Sword. The Great British Sword writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, how come Jews are called Jews? What happened to the other 12 tribes of Israel?" Unquote. Fantastic question, British Sword. 10 out of the 12 tribes disappeared. They assimilated and they just basically disappeared. Now, we believe that when the Messiah comes, that the 12 tribe, that all 12 tribes are going to be once again revealed, and it's going to be back. We're going to have the 12 tribes again. But right now, 10 out of the 12 tribes have disappeared. The only tribes that are left are Yehuda, Judah. That's why we're called Jews, because the vast majority of Jews come from the tribe of Judah, from Shevet Yehuda, from the tribe of Judah. And there are some from Binyamin. Binyamin is Benjamin. You have some Benjamin also, the remnant of Benjamin also still exists. And you have the Levites, who were the priestly tribe. Now, the Levites were not counted as one of the 12 tribes because they didn't receive any inheritance in the land of Israel. They were scattered among, they were like the priestly tribes, scattered among all the different tribes living throughout without their own inheritance of land, because they had a special spiritual role to play among the Jewish people. So you have some Levites and you have some survivors, some remnants surviving from Binyamin, from Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, and most of the Jews, though, are from Yehuda, from Judah. And that's why the Jews are called Yehudim. Yehuda, the tribe is Yehuda, Judah, and the Jews are called Yehudim in Hebrew, which means Jews. Jews come from the tribe of Judah. But where the lost tribes are, and you know, they are so assimilated and so separated from the Jewish people at this point that it's impossible to really know right now. Anyway, thank you very much, British Sword. And now we go to the great PJC. The great PJC writes, and I quote, "Hello, Chaim, who is uglier in your opinion, Debbie Wasserman Schultz or Nancy Pelosi?" Unquote. What a choice. Oh, what a choice. For me, PJC, you know there's nothing I hate more than a self-hating Jew. Maybe because I'm Jewish, I have this hang-up. I can't stand traitors to the Jewish people and self-hating Jews. And that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the most obnoxious, disgusting, evil, self-hating Jew. She is, by the way, for those who don't know, she's the chairwoman. She would never say chairwoman, by the way. She's a chairperson. But anyway, she's the chairwoman of the Democrat National Committee. And she so zealously fights for Barack Hussein Obama, who wants to cut her throat and wants to cut the throat of every Jew in the world. And she so zealously fights for him. She's the most obnoxious, disgusting person. But she's such an ineffective spokesperson, you know, that sometimes I'm almost happy when they put her on. Because I really don't think she's a good... I think she turns people off when she goes on there. You know, when she starts speaking, I think it turns people off. I don't know. But I would have to pick her. Even though Nancy Pelosi is a very evil and disgusting individual. No question about it. Anyway, thank you very much, PJC. And now we go to the great Dan Ben Noach. Dan Ben Noach is the ultimate example of what we need for JTFers. Look at what Dan Ben Noach does. He translated hundreds of Hebrew videos into English. He favorites, comments, and likes all of our videos. Every time we put up a video up, whether it's in English or in Hebrew, Dan Ben Noach is always there commenting, favoriting, and liking every single video. He does it both on YouTube and on Facebook without fail. He promotes us on YouTube and on Facebook. He's put up videos of his own all over the place that have gotten many views. Some of them have gotten his video on Samantha Powers has 82,000 views. And he has many other videos with large numbers of views. I mean, look at all he's done. And then, you know, when Dan Ben Noach puts up a thread on the forum or posts on the forum, you know it's going to be good. I mean, his threads are excellent. So Dan Ben Noach is, I mean, that's, you know, if you want to look toward an example of the type of person who really is a model for everyone, it's Dan Ben Noach. Baruch Hashem that Dan Ben Noach is working with us and is an administrator on our forum. Dan Ben Noach writes now, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, does the Jewish law of leaving a portion of a field for the poor legitimize any social welfare programs?" Unquote. Okay, great question. Great question. And the answer is that the current government social welfare programs are in no way similar to what the Torah commands Jews to do. The Torah does command Jews to help the poor and to leave a portion of their field so that the poor can come and can gather fruits and vegetables and can gather for their needs. The farmers and are required to leave a section of that. That is one of the that we have commandments in the Torah. Some of the commandments in the Torah deal with that issue. But that is in no way similar to the government social welfare programs that we have today. The government social welfare programs that we have today encourage dependency. The reason that we have the Torah programs are just to get people by so that they won't starve and they and their families won't starve, but we do want to encourage, the Torah does encourage even the poor to find work and to try to get them self-sufficient. The best thing you can do for poor people is to get them a job and to get them self-sufficient and get them an education and get them on their own feet. That's the best thing you can do. Until we get there, helping them out by giving them fruits and vegetables from the farm and helping them get by is considered to be is a commandment. I mean, we're supposed to help them get by. But government social welfare programs are designed to keep people dependent. We have generations of lazy people on welfare that never leave the welfare programs. People on welfare, food stamps, and other programs who never, never lift a finger to go out and work. I'm talking about able-bodied young men and women who generation after generation just live off the dole and want other people to pay for their programs. That's the worst thing that these programs can do for anyone. When I was a little boy, 10% of black babies in America were illegitimate, were born out of wedlock. 10% when I was a little boy. It's now at least 70%, according to the census figures, and probably more, because you know how many people will admit that their children are illegitimate? But it's at least 70%. All of these welfare programs and the trillions of dollars that America has spent have only made a bad situation much worse. Much worse. They encourage decadence, they encourage immorality, they encourage laziness, they encourage addiction to drugs and alcohol and gambling and all other types of terrible, destructive vices. Those programs are destructive. And so, you know, we could really see from, and by the way, the Torah does not say that we're supposed to give to evil people, to our enemies and evil people. That we're not supposed to give for. The Torah speaks about giving among our brothers and sisters to give a portion for the poor, and among good people, among good Jews and good Gentiles who are decent people and who are sincere, who sincerely not just a bunch of bums going around begging, like you see in every big city, you see these bums who spend their whole life going around begging, even though they get a check from the government and they get free food and free phones from Barack Hussein Obama and they get free everything on a silver platter, and they still go around begging like bums so that they can buy more drugs and more booze and continue to live the way they live. They don't have to pay for rent, they don't have to pay for food, they don't have to pay for education, they don't have to pay for clothes, everything they get is free. And they still go around begging because they want more and more. They still expect people who do work for a living to give them out of their hard-earned money, to give them even more. Whereas there are genuinely poor people out there, there are genuinely poor people, something in every generation. And those people who genuinely need a helping hand, like there are several women that I know who are in their late 70s, 80s, my mother's generation, or friends of my mother. And these women only get a Social Security check. That's all they get. They're widows. Their husbands passed away. They're widows. Some of them have health problems. All they have is a Social Security check, which isn't much. And they live in New York City, which is very expensive, and they really have a hard time making ends meet. They sometimes don't have enough food to eat, literally do not have enough food to eat sometimes. And so there are wonderful Jewish organizations that help them with food and that give them meat, deliver them hot meals. Those are good things. Those are good programs. Those people deserve help. If it's an 80-year-old lady who worked all her life and just doesn't have enough to make ends meet, and she's a nice person, a wonderful person, and she's just her Social Security check just isn't enough to pay for rent and everything else, that you, all the other expensive stuff in New York City, those are the type of people who do deserve us, who do deserve help. But these lazy bums who get everything for free, and if they wanted to, could get, they could get free education, they get free everything, they could advance themselves, they even would get, they even because of affirmative action, they'd even get good jobs because of their race if they would just apply themselves. These lazy bums deserve nothing and should get nothing. And so there's no relation between modern government social welfare programs and what the Torah commands. No relation whatsoever. It's completely different. The Torah is based on righteousness and truth and sincere people who need help, and we want to put them on their own feet, and, or if they're elderly and they just can't anymore, we want to be kind and compassionate, and we want to show love toward them. But comparing that to the bums that we have on welfare and food stamps in most cases in the United States today, no comparison. No comparison. Anyway, thank you very much, Dan Ben-Noach. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, another example of a great JTF. Dr. Dan is all, I mean, first of all, his threads on the forum and his posts on the forum are always so wise and so logical. And whenever they, you know, if there's an argument going on the forum or something, or, you know, sometimes human beings, we're all human beings, sometimes we have arguments that are unnecessary and other things that come up on the forum. Dr. Dan is always there as a voice of wisdom and reason and common sense. He also is an example to JTFers. I mean, this is an example of JTFers, of someone that we can look to as a model for what we're supposed to be doing in this generation. To try to make a positive difference. Dr. Dan writes now, and I quote, Would it have been appropriate if Paul Ryan said, "Excuse me, Mr. Biden, please show some respect and stop interrupting me during the VP debates," unquote. Absolutely. Absolutely he should have said that. I would have gone even further. I mean, I would have said, something? This is a debate for Vice President of the United States. One of us, one of the two of us, is going to be a heartbeat away from the presidency, from the most important office in the world. And you're giggling and laughing at these important issues and interrupting and showing such rudeness and such boorishness and such obnoxiousness on national television instead of respectfully debating your opponent and instead of coming up with intelligent, substantive reasons why you disagree with me. You're giggling, laughing, interrupting, and not even letting me speak. I would have said, you know, the same contempt that you're showing for me now, the same contempt and the snickering and the sneering and the smirking and the giggling that you're showing for me now, this is why you and Barack Hussein Obama have been unable to have any, to get anything done with Republicans in Congress. You will never get anything done because you hate your opponents. You have contempt for your opponents. You ridicule and belittle your opponents. You despise them. And so you'll never get anything done. That's what I would have said to him. But I would have made a big deal about this in the debate. I would, over and over again, every time he did that, I would have made a big deal about that. I would have let him go on in the beginning just a little bit so that people see how he's behaving, so I could make a big deal of it. Let him fall into the trap, and then I would have gone after him on that. Absolutely, he should have said that. Biden's behavior was just, it was just unbelievable. Unbelievable that this is what we're, and 12 years ago when Al Gore did much less, he was just sighing, Al Gore, in his debate with George W. Bush in 2000. People can look at the first Gore-Bush debate. You can look it up on YouTube. He rolled his eyes and he was sighing a couple of times. Do you know that he lost that debate because of that? Because Americans thought that was rude? Look what we've come to in 12 years. Now, Biden wasn't just sighing a little bit. Biden was 100 times worse than Gore. Biden is giggling and laughing and interrupting and, just rude and obnoxious. And nobody, that's perfectly fine. Can you imagine, by the way, if a Republican had behaved like that? Can you imagine what the media would have done to a Republican who acted like that? I would have said that too in the debate. If I were Paul Ryan, I would have said, "What would the media do if I had been acting toward you in this manner? If a Republican acted like this, I would have said that in the debate as well." Anyway, thank you, Dr. Dan. Great point. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, updates on Syria. Where the Kurds fit in on all this? Okay, let's answer that first. The next question is something else, but let's start with that. The Kurds are about 9% of Syria's population. About 9% of the Syrian population are Kurds. And they live in the northern part of Syria. They want an independent Kurdistan. They want an independent nation. Some Kurds live in Turkey. Some of them live in Syria. Some of them live in Iran, Iraq. They're spread out over all of these countries, and they've always wanted an independent nation. And so they're hoping that in this vacuum, in this power vacuum, they're going to be able to get some independence or at least some autonomy and be able to break away from the Arabs who have been oppressing them. The Kurds are Muslims. But, you know, Muslims are very intolerant of other Muslims. And so they're fighting for their independence against the Arabs, which I think is wonderful. When Muslims fight Muslims, I root for both sides usually. I'm all for it. So let them fight, and I hope they do break away. I hope they do split up a piece of Syria and do break away. I hope it does happen. And now Tag Mechir writes, should Israel step in to destroy chemical weapons, unquote. I don't think Israel should step in right now. I think that the Arabs are doing a good job of killing each other, and I don't think that Israel should step in and stop that. I mean, that's a positive thing, in my opinion. However, there is a danger here because the Assad regime, you're absolutely right, the Assad regime created dangerous chemical weapons. We don't want those chemical weapons falling into the hands of terrorists who are going to, you know, go out and decide that they're going to carry out terrorist attacks with those chemical weapons against Western targets. So, of course, that could be a danger. So Israel has to keep a sharp eye on what's going on. If there's any indication that those chemical weapons are being transferred to these terrorist proxies of Syria, then Israel might have to step in order to destroy the chemical weapons. That's possible. But as long as that's not happening, until that happens, we should sit back and let the Muslims do to each other what Muslims are so good at doing to each other. Anyway, thank you very much, Tag Mechir. And now we go to the great Say No to Islam, who writes, and I quote, please curse Russia, Yimach Shema V'Zichra. Russians believe that Jews want Muslims and Christians to kill each other and there is no Islamic threat. That's what they say, unquote. Well, you know, Russia is very, very anti-Semitic and very anti-Israel and always has been. And they do support a nuclearized Iran. They lie when they claim that they're also against Iran developing nuclear weapons. That's not true. They're the ones they're the number one group. They and the Chinese are the two countries that are helping Iran, Muslim terrorist Iran, develop nuclear bombs more than anyone else. So that's, you know, it's just a lie. For centuries, Russia has been an anti-Semitic country. They persecuted and tortured the Jewish people in the worst way. They murdered them in pogroms, even though the Jews were the most blessed thing that ever happened to Russia. So, you know, there's no question that there's a serious problem there, and Vladimir Putin, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, and the Russian regime are very anti-Israel. They want Israel to be destroyed. And they view the Muslims as a convenient force against the United States. They're happy because they see the Muslims are attacking America and want to destroy America, and Russia thinks America is the number one enemy, and so they view the Muslims as a good force in that respect. And also they hate Israel and hate the Jews. So they're on the side of the Muslims. In the battle against America and Israel, they are definitely on the side of the Muslims, and they are definitely an enemy. They are still an enemy. Anyway, thank you very much, Say No to Islam. And now we go to the great Brennan fan who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, now that Romney has a real fighting chance, do you think we will see extra outrageous dirty tricks against him, unquote. I think we're already seeing it, Brennan fan. The unemployment figures were rigged. They did not go down to 7.8%. That's a lie. And not just the monthly unemployment figures. A week later, we saw the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who are Obama appointees, Obama, basically black Obama appointees there. We saw these people now coming out with statistics on new people, on the new applications for unemployment insurance, new people reporting that they're unemployed. And all of a sudden they said there's a drop of 30,000 this week in the people applying for unemployment benefits. A drop of 30,000, very encouraging figure. It all the way went all the way down 30,000, which would be a big drop. But if you look at the statistics, it didn't drop 30,000. It went up 26,000. But they said we have to adjust the figures for what they call seasonal adjustments. They said a drop of 26,000, an increase of 26,000 really means a drop of 30,000 because of the season that we're in. Oh, please. I mean, they are playing games with these statistics and releasing statistics that are so bogus. This is such baloney. And by the way, it's not just Chaim Ben Pesach saying this. It's people like Jack Welch, who was the CEO of General Electric. Steve Forbes, who's a pretty serious business guy, a very big serious business guy, and a lot of the Fox News experts and Wall Street experts have all said, people from the Wall Street Journal have said, they don't believe these figures. They believe that they're playing games with these figures. And they are. So they're already playing dirty tricks. I mean, Brennan fan, think about it. Government employees releasing statistics on unemployment that are just lies? I mean, this is what they do in third world banana republics. This is already dirty tricks. And that's just one out of many things that may come up yet. All types of things. Get ready for all types of things. I mean, and who knows what the news media is planning to do to Romney. You remember what the media did to other Republican candidates over the years. Who knows what the media is planning to spring on Romney? Who knows what type of surprise they're going to come up with just at the last minute, just in time to defeat Romney. So, yes, I think we already are seeing dirty tricks, and I think, and unfortunately, I think we're going to see more. And we've got to call them, but you know, we've got to call it right away. We've got to say right away, we've got to attack them on it so that they don't get the political benefit they want to get from doing these dirty tricks. Anyway, thank you, Brennan fan. And now we go to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, "How good are you really doing when you can't treat your opponent respectfully? Did Biden destroy Ryan's credibility or pathetically show his weakness?" Unquote. Well, I mean, I agree with you that it says a lot about Biden that he has to behave the way he behaved. On the other hand, I would have been, you know, there are certain things that Paul Ryan should have said in that debate. He should have, I mean, why didn't he mention that Joe Biden said that the middle class has been buried during the past 4 years? Joe Biden said the middle class has been buried in the past 4 years. Who's been in the White House in the past 4 years? Biden admitted in his speech the middle class has been buried. That's a quote. In the past 4 years. Buried during the past 4 years. And Ryan didn't even bring that up. Biden admitted that they plan a $1 trillion tax increase on the American people. He admitted this in his speech just about a week before the debate. And Ryan didn't bring that up either. I mean, you know, what is this? I hope Mitt Romney brings these things up in the next debate. I hope so. I mean, we've got to support Romney and Ryan. We have to support them. But I would have been much more aggressive in going after the record of these two evil, lying, cheating, backstabbing charlatans, Barack Hussein Obama and Joe Biden. I would have gone after them really aggressively because they deserve to be gone after aggressively. Anyway, thank you, LKZ. And now we go to the great West Coast JTF. West Coast JTF, again, this is the guy who came up with that great initiative, created the JTF archive page where you can see so many of our JTF programs, including a lot of the Ask JTF programs, so many of our old programs. Great audio and video archive, and you can see it all on jtfarchive.org. And West Coast JTF writes, and I quote, "Given that the Democrats are now booing Jews at their political rallies, do you think a German-style Holocaust is a possibility in the U.S.?" Unquote. I have always felt that that's possible. I mean, given history and what we've seen in history and human nature, that's always a possibility. That's something that if you have a real crisis, you never know who people will turn to. Of course, that's always been a possibility. And contrary to what Jews, what some Jews think, a lot of Jews think that that's going to come from the so-called right, and it's going to come from the white majority in America. The real danger here is from the left. The danger here is from those black, Arab, Muslim, and other Jew-hating forces on the left that were booing the Jews at their Democrat convention. Those are the ones that really want Jewish blood. I mean, they want to kill Jews. They want Jewish blood. They want Jews dead. And Jews are funding the Democrat Party and supporting Democrats. 78% voted for Obama in the last election. I mean, just unbelievable insanity. Unbelievable insanity. That's why JTF is so important. I mean, there has to be a voice of sanity to stand up and just expose all of this and say, what the hell is going on over here? How could people be so crazy? Anyway, thank you so much, West Coast JTF. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Can Mitt Romney realistically win the election without winning Ohio?" Unquote. Okay, let's start with that, because the other question is a different question. You have two questions here. Let's start with the first one on Ohio. It would be very hard for Mitt Romney to win without Ohio. It's theoretically possible, but it would be hard. Ohio has, I think, 18 electoral votes, if I'm not mistaken. And you need 270 to win. It just doesn't add up for Romney. If you look at the states that Romney is expected to carry, and you look at the states Obama is expected to carry, without Ohio, it just doesn't add up for Romney. It's very hard. Theoretically, it's possible, but it would be very hard. He would have to win almost every other swing state, like 7 out of 8 of the remaining swing states he would have to win, which, of course, would be very hard to do if he doesn't carry Ohio. It would be very hard for him to do that. No Republican has ever been elected president. Never. No Republican in American history has ever been elected without carrying Ohio. So it's really, really important. And right now, Obama still has a slight lead in Ohio. So that's just another reminder to our people, we got a real fight ahead of us. And now EB writes, "As of today, are Pennsylvania and or Michigan in play for Romney?" Unquote. They should be. I mean, they should be. I don't think Romney should give up on Pennsylvania and Michigan. By the way, if Romney, by some miracle, carried Pennsylvania and or Michigan, that could make up for losing Ohio. That would make up for it. And then, Romney could win without Ohio if he did carry Pennsylvania and Michigan. Obama is probably ahead in Pennsylvania and Michigan right now, but it's gotten closer since the last debate, since Romney won the last debate, it's gotten closer. So, I think Romney should make a play for those states. I think Romney should try to take Pennsylvania and Michigan. Anyway, thank you very much, EB22. And now we go to the great Chai. The great Chai writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, a Dvar Torah on Parashat Noach coming this week, and it's Haftarah. You are so insightful," unquote. Thank you so much, Chai. And this coming week will be Parashat Noach. Parashat Noach is the parasha of Noah and the flood, Hamabul. And it's the second parasha in the Torah. The parasha, by the way, means the Torah portion that we read every week. If we're going to speak about Parashat Noach, the first thing I think that we see in the parasha is that it says that Noah was righteous for his generation, that he was a saint, that he was righteous for his generation. He was righteous in the eyes of God, but for his generation. He is not considered to be, the rabbis in the Talmud do not consider Noach to be on the same level as Abraham Avinu, as Abraham our father. Why? Why wasn't Noah considered to be as righteous as Abraham? Well, let's look at the differences. Noah, before the flood, when he was building the ark to prepare for the flood, and he was doing what God told him to do, he listened to God, he believed in God, he was building the ark, but he didn't go out and warn people. He was building the ark, and when people came to him and asked him, "What are you doing?" he did tell them. He explained to them, "There's going to be a flood, and I'm building the ark." So he did explain to them, but they would have to come to him and ask him. He did not go out and actively try to change people, actively try to save people, actively try to move people. He didn't do that. He didn't preach, he didn't warn, he didn't go out to try to save people. Abraham Avinu, Abraham, on the other hand, spent his whole life traveling all over the place, teaching people that there's just one God, teaching people the truth in a time when everybody believed in idols. Abraham Avinu risked his life over and over again and was thrown in an oven, by the way. He was thrown in an oven for that and survived miraculously, which is another story, another interesting story. But he went out and tried to change people and tried to change the situation. In most cases, he didn't succeed in convincing people. In some cases he did, but in most cases he didn't. But he still was not discouraged and he still fought on. And so we have a lesson here to learn that we must go out and warn and try to change things. We have an obligation not to be silent. We have an obligation to try to change people. And certain people will listen and certain people won't. But we have to speak out. We have to tell the truth. And then after the flood, Noah was very depressed because the whole human race had been wiped out. It was a tremendous Holocaust. So he was very, very depressed. And so what does he do? He builds a vineyard and starts drinking wine to escape the trauma of the flood. He started drinking. And he would get drunk all the time. And we see the stories that happened. Even bad things happened to him because he was getting drunk. And he was just chronically depressed and drinking. And again, it's understandable. I mean, the trauma of the flood and the trauma of seeing so many people killed, of course it's understandable that he was depressed. But look at the difference between him and Avraham. Avraham faced so many setbacks in his life. A lot of tests and setbacks. He was tested by God 10 times, 10 big tests. And yet Avraham remained faithful, even though the whole world said he was wrong. Where do we get the word Avraham from? We get it from the word ever. Ever means side. Because the rabbis teach us, Avraham stood on one side and the whole world stood on the other side. He was all alone in believing in one God. Everyone else believed in idols. And everybody said to him, you mean only you know better? You think you know better? You're the only one who's right and everybody else is wrong? Only you know? Doesn't that sound familiar? And even though he was all alone, and even though he fought lonely, very difficult battles and went through 10 very, very tough tests in life, he never stopped faithfully, loyally, consistently believing in God. Never gave up. Never gave up for 1 minute. And Abraham was promised he would have a son named Yitzchak. Isaac. And he was already 99 years old and still didn't have the son. And then God told him, you're going to have your son now. That your wife Sarah, who was 90 years old when she gave birth, your wife Sarah is going to give birth to Yitzchak. And so he didn't have Yitzchak until the age of 100. And yet he still believed. He still remained faithful, even though he had been promised. He could have said, you know, when he was 90, 95, 99, he could have said, oh, well, you know, why didn't God keep his word? Hashem promised me. No. He believed. He remained faithful. And maybe he thought he wasn't going to have a son, but he thought maybe there's a reason. But whatever the reason was, he remained faithful to God and never stopped fighting. Even though he was a very old man, he never stopped fighting for what he believed in. And then God tells him to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. He didn't give up in despair and say, after all this time I waited 100 years to have a son, and this is the continuation of the legacy that I fought for so hard, and that's the only truth in the world, and now you want me to kill my own son? He didn't say that. He loyally was ready to do whatever Hashem tells him to do. Hashem, of course, didn't intend for him to really do that. He never gave up and never despaired, even though, I mean, that's the most, you can't get a more powerful test than that. And he never gave up and never despaired. He was loyal and faithful and truthful and honest and principled to the very end. And so, Noach, in this week's parasha, was righteous. He was a very righteous, wonderful person, but he wasn't on the level of Abraham. We have to be a light unto the nations, and a holy nation, a nation of priests. We have to go out and try to make this a better world. Even when things are bad, we can't give up. We can't let things get us down. No matter how bad things look, we have to always remember that in the end, the good guys are going to win. Because the ruler of the universe is good. And he promised. And he always keeps his word. We may not see it in our lifetime, but eventually that's going to happen. And we have to do our part, our share, in bringing that about as best as we can. You know, it says in the Israeli national anthem, Hatikva, the hope. The climax of the song. Hasi is in Hebrew, the climax. I'm already speaking to you in Hebrew now. The climax of the song is Od lo avda tikvatenu. That means our hope is not yet lost. Now think about that. The Jews were singing, our hope is not yet lost, after 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, after every country in the world closed their doors to the Jews, after every country in the world turned the Jews away and sent them back to the death camps, when the German Nazi newspapers showed pictures of the Jews being turned away and had headlines saying, nobody wants them. And the Jewish people saw this and saw most of their brothers and sisters in Europe burned and gassed alive. Babies and children and women and whole families burned and gassed alive. Tortured in the most unbelievable way. The worst crime in human history. And here we are. Right after that, the Jews are singing in their song, our hope is not yet lost. That is why the Jews came back to the land of Israel. They didn't give up. They didn't stop believing. And so with iron fists and blazing guns, they redeemed the land of their forefathers 2,000 years after being expelled from their homeland. 2,000 years later, after all they went through, including the Holocaust, they still didn't give up. That is what our destiny is, and that's what we're supposed to be, and we're supposed to inspire righteous Gentiles to be the same way, and to have the same belief and faith in the need to fight on and not give up and do what we're supposed to do in every generation, to fight for the truth. That's one of the lessons of our parasha this week, Parashat Noach. How would the world have been if Noach, instead of drinking and instead of getting discouraged, if he and others like him throughout history had instead faced the problem and done what Abraham had done? The world, obviously, we'd be in much better shape today. I'm not blaming Noach. He was certainly a very righteous man too, and I understand why he was depressed and hurt by what happened. But we've got to overcome that, and if we're able to overcome that despite all the setbacks and fight for the truth, then great things will happen. That's the lesson, in my opinion, one of the great lessons of this week's parasha. And in addition to that, we have the Haftarah this week. The Haftarah is the portion of the prophets that we read together with the parasha, together with the portion of the Torah that we read. The Torah is the first 5 books of Moses. And then we also read a portion of the prophets every week. That's called the Haftarah. This week's portion is from Yeshayahu Nun Dalet. Yeshayahu Nun Dalet is Isaiah 44. And it's such, like all of Isaiah, it's so stirring and so beautiful and so uplifting. It's about the return of Israel and the end of the exile and the suffering. And again, it's the reward. It's the reward for not having given up hope, and for still believing. It's that reward that comes in the end. And we, in our lifetime, saw that happen. 63 years ago, the state of Israel came into being. We're in the beginning of that great redemption. Just the beginning. It could take hundreds of years. I don't know how long it's going to take before the Messiah comes and before it's completed. You know, I don't know if it'll happen in our lifetime. Who knows? But we're in that period now. And so we have every reason to dream of and hope for the future, because we know eventually, one way or another, eventually those great things that we are promised will come to pass. Eventually they will come to pass. How and when and exactly when and if it'll happen in our lifetime, that we don't know, but eventually it will happen. Anyway, thank you so much, Chai. And now we go to Scorched Earth, who is a new member of the forum. Welcome to the forum. Scorched Earth writes, and I quote, "What is your feeling about Rabbi Mordechai Friedman, particularly his demeanor on his videos?" Unquote. Well, I'm grateful to Rabbi Mordechai Friedman for uploading four videos of mine on his website. He actually did take videos of mine that I think have thousands of views. He copied my videos that I did on four English language videos that I did, which is something everybody should be doing. He copied it and put it on his YouTube account, and I think that there are I believe we have a large number of views on those videos. I think I don't remember exactly, but I remember him taking four of those videos. That was several years ago. I don't remember his demeanor. I don't remember on his videos. I don't remember if I saw his videos, if I saw him on his videos, or because it's been years. Has he done videos recently, or referring to something recently? I haven't seen him doing any videos recently. So I honestly can't say, because I don't remember seeing his videos. I don't remember seeing any of his videos recently. Anyway, thank you, Scorched Earth. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim. Do you believe that Obama will pull an October surprise in order to win the election?" Unquote. Maimonides, yes, I think that we're seeing that already. I think that the unemployment report was an October surprise, as I told Brennan Fan, who asked a somewhat similar question. Yes, I think we're beginning to see that. I think we're beginning to see that there is no dirty trick, and there's no underhanded corrupt action that Obama and his administration and his campaign and the news media that works with him, there's nothing that they will not do. There's nothing they won't do in order to win this election, including cheating on the election. There may be attempts to perpetrate election fraud. We already saw Acorn, which is, you know, funded by the Obama supporters. You know, we know that Acorn has registered large numbers of voters fraudulently. So we're going to see all types of shenanigans here. And again, we've got to keep our eyes open, and we've got to expose it as soon as it comes up, because if it's a close election, these types of things can make all the difference. As far as another October surprise, like a surprise war or some other surprise action, nothing would surprise me coming from this corrupt, evil president and this corrupt, evil administration with the corrupt, evil news media that supports them. Anyway, thank you very much, Maimonides. And I want to thank all of our great JTFers for another show that I very much enjoyed doing. I very much enjoyed sharing some time with our great JTFers, as I always do. Until next week, Shalom.